Have you ever found yourself in a tough conversation about faith, unsure of what to say or how to say it? Maybe with a skeptic, a friend, or even a family member? We want to help. That's why we're giving you a free download of 5 Steps to Having Better Conversations. This powerful guide will equip you to navigate faith discussions with confidence, wisdom, and grace, so that you can share your beliefs in a way that truly connects. Get your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Don't miss out. Start having better, more meaningful conversations today.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're going to look at some major changes to how medical research is being funded in the United States. A large, complicated body called the National Institutes of Health, the NIH, has come under the microscope of Donald Trump and his cost-cutting goons, led by Elon Musk, and is the subject of a very major kind of funding freeze. Its grants are being curtailed. We're going to get on to explain it just in a second, but this particularly caught our eye, didn't it, Dad? Because we had on this very podcast only a few months ago a lovely Christian scientist called Francis Collins. People might remember that conversation. If not, do scroll up. It's only a few months ago. Who is an evangelical Christian, but also a kind of world-leading genetic scientist, was most famous for leading the Human Genome Project, and then served under, I think, 3 different presidents as the director of the National Institutes of Health, including serving in that capacity during the COVID pandemic, and so was one of the kind of leading public health figures trying to steer America through that crisis. He stood down a few at the end of some point last year, I think, just in the kind of tail end of Joe Biden's administration, but went back to working as a kind of jobbing laboratory scientist doing some research, and has announced just in the last few weeks that he has now quit entirely and retired from the NIH. Didn't say why, but you can read between the lines in his statement, which he called the crown jewel of the federal government, that he is very unhappy, I think, with the way the Trump administration is kind of gutting that agency.
Yes, I'm well aware of the NIH because much of the area of research in which I worked for decades, trying to prevent and treat brain injury in newborn babies, I worked very closely with some very eminent NIH researchers, and the NIH funded one of the major trials which demonstrated that the cooling therapy that I was involved with was effective, and so it's extremely painful for me to see such a remarkable institution, which has had such a positive impact just in my own personal experience, being threatened by developments, particularly by Trump. It's important to understand it is an absolutely massive organization which has been built up over the years, funded by the American federal government to support medical research, and it does this in a number of ways. Partly it has its own research labs, it hires scientists, and it's a very competitive process. It's very prestigious to be employed by the NIH. And they have a whole number of divisions working on medical research. But the other way the NIH works is that it provides grants for researchers literally around the world. So a scientific researcher in somewhere in Europe or in Africa, in Australia, Asia, they can apply to the NIH for a research grant to support the work they're doing. And the NIH, and they continue to work in their own labs wherever they are, but they are supported by the NIH. And the total sums spent are mind-boggling. I think in the article we found...
$48 billion.
$48 billion a year.
Supporting the work of about 300,000 external scientists.
So it's an extraordinary institution, but it has suddenly, complete turmoil has apparently hit the institution ever since Trump became president.
And what is so infuriating, I think, watching on is it seems so much of this is kind of this chaos attempt to kind of restrict its funding, stop its ability to make grants, is driven by a lot of kind of quite petty animus. So did you spot so the NIH is kind of like an umbrella organization of 27 different kind of centers of excellence targeting different areas of research, and one of its infectious disease institute was led by a guy called Anthony Fauci, who again became very famous during the COVID pandemic when he was the kind of, if you know, the kind of Chris Whitty of America, the kind of chief government scientist specializing in infectious disease, to kind of telling us how we should try and survive the COVID pandemic. And obviously, as people will be aware, a lot of the things around vaccines and masks became an incredibly toxic kind of politicized culture war. Basically, the part of the reason the Trump people are going after the NIH is because they're holding a grudge against Anthony Fauci. And so the bloke they have appointed as a temporary kind of interim head of the NIH is a scientist who is kind of unknown among, it's called Matthew Mamoli. He's unknown among the kind of senior ranks of the NIH. He's not someone who anyone thought would be in this position. And it turns out the only reason he's got there is because he pushed back against some of Fauci's opinions on vaccines and things during COVID and kind of caught the attention of the right-wing media, who has then filtered that up to Trump and some of his lieutenants. So it just seems like this fairly specialist kind of institution is being turned on its head over some spectacularly petty reasons.
Yes, and then what's happened, there was a hiring freeze and a travel ban and then cancellation of meetings, and scientists were told they could purchase, they weren't even now able to purchase basic lab supplies to keep experiments going. And then contradictory emails, and they've fired a lot of probationers, the people who had just been appointed, and paused a lot of funding, and a lot of people have resigned, and it just feels like, you know, it 20 years of excellence, which has been patiently built up by thousands of eminent scientists, and it feels like it's being destroyed in a few weeks by people who fundamentally have no understanding of why this is important.
Yeah. And as you say, one of the biggest things the NIH does is issue grants, billions of dollars worth of government grants to medical researchers at labs and universities across the world. And there was a period where all of that was just abruptly stopped, and it was NIH staff were banned from making grants, and then a court tried to overturn that order, and then it's been kind of to and fro, very confusing. Then they get a message saying you're not allowed to fund these things about diversity and inclusion or people exploring gender and sex, and then that's been cancelled by a court order. So it's very chaotic, and it hasn't really settled down, but it's really of a piece, isn't it, with a lot of what the Trump administration is trying to do, which is both to massively gut vast swathes of kind of federal bureaucracy, but also to kind of bring things in line, in kind of fealty, in loyalty to his particular vision and his ideas, even things that have previously been completely apolitical. You know, something like funding medical research has for decades been supported by both Republicans and Democrats. And as the presidency has changed, you know, there might be tweaks to how it's funded or what is a priority, but basically everyone was in agreement that it's a good thing for the government to fund medical research. And now suddenly all of that is on the up for grabs.
That's right. And because the vast majority of people are completely unaware of this, of what's going on and of its implications, it's really only research scientists in the field who are really aware about NIH, even patients who benefit from the medical research. It's a shadowy organization. It doesn't go in for a lot of publicity. And therefore, you know, there is no public unrest about this. There are no people saying, gosh, this is going to have implications for me or my family or the medical care I'm getting. It's seen as an elite activity of no real significance, which is so far from the truth. And the other thing is, because this is much more than just affecting America. This is going to affect research science in so many places across the globe.
Mm. So tell us a little bit more about why is it so important that the US government funds medical research? Why isn't this something that could be picked up by the private sector?
Well, the truth is that medical research is very expensive. And it frequently fails, almost by definition, even when you have the best scientists you can possibly find and the best hypotheses and so on. When a large amount of money is spent, it's known that a great deal of medical research ends up in failure. It's not a complete waste of time, because actually in research, a negative result can be extremely important. Because basically you publicize a negative result. You say, we spent 5 years trying out this approach and the evidence is it doesn't work, and therefore don't do it for yourself. We've demonstrated this is not the way to do. Think of something else. That's how science develops. Science depends on negative results as much as on positive results. But I've just remembered a friend of mine who was another research scientist. We used to sort of commiserate with one another, you know, when things were going badly. And he said, yeah, medical research is basically passing from one disaster to the next with undiminished enthusiasm. And there's certainly an element of truth in that. That's just what the nature of medical research is. And occasionally and extraordinarily, it works and astonishing things happening. And to my astonishment, I happen to be working in a particular area of research which did lead to a very significant advance for care of babies around the world. But that's pretty unusual. So it's very expensive. And in most areas, there is no significant profit to be made. The drug industry is really the one big difference. Maybe the drug industry and medical devices are two areas where there is a significant profit to be made. But unfortunately, the effect of profits then distorts research towards the most profitable areas. So the reason why there are any number of drugs like tranquilizers and antidepressants is because these are extremely profitable, because people have to take these agents day after day, week after week, sometimes for years, and therefore it's all adding up to profit. Unfortunately, there's a real problem with antibiotics, particularly making new antibiotics for multi-resistant organisms, because it's extremely expensive and risky, and you have to spend literally millions, hundreds of millions of pounds developing a new antibiotic. And yet, if it's only used for the most severe cases, it's only going to give treatment for a few days, and it's simply not possible to get back all the money that you've spent on research. And therefore, commercial incentives, although they're valuable, they are always are limited in terms of medical research. And so in the UK, the majority of medical research is again funded either by the government, funded by the Medical Research Council, or by something called the National Institutes for Health Research, which is money which is the NHS supports, or else it's supported by charities.
Cancer Research UK.
Exactly, kind of heart disease or whatever it is, money raised from the public. It's just far too simplistic to think that the profit motive is going to support the billions of amounts that is required in medical research.
And it's fascinating to me because I think a lot of British people are quite familiar with this conversation about the kind of complexities and difficulties with introducing a profit motive to healthcare, which is not like other kind of industries or businesses. And you know, our society has gone down a quite a radical solution of saying, you know, all healthcare should be socialized and provided by the taxpayer through the NHS. And America obviously has a much more privatized system. But even America, bastion of free market capitalism, has acknowledged that medical research is going to have to be nationalized, or at least part nationalized. That's been accepted across the board, even by the most kind of libertarian right-wing Republicans for a long time.
Yes, that's right. And I think there really is no alternative. And positively, I mean, this is one of the really positive aspects of big government, so-called. Of course, there are inefficiencies, there is corruption of different sort of levels in that, you know, the way that the money is given out is not always in the most equitable and strategic way. But nonetheless, in principle, over the decades, government-funded research is actually the large majority of all the medical advances that have been made have come from government-funded research. But unfortunately, I think this story is not well known. Even in the UK, I think most people are pretty unaware about the Medical Research Council or the NIHR. Mm. And they would be much more aware of people raising money from the general public. Mm. But nonetheless, for those who are in insiders, I think we're all aware what an incredibly important area this is. And in particular, government funding is distributed, in theory at least, on the basis of excellence. It's not about, you know, is this politically acceptable? Does this fit with fashionable ideas? It's fundamentally, the test is this at an excellent, is this research the very best at an excellent international level? And is it likely to lead to significant advances in the care of human beings? I mean, veterinary research is also done in the care of animals. So the test is, and a huge amount of work goes into trying to direct money to the most important and significant areas.
Mm. I was really struck by something, some of the things that Francis Collins said in his retirement statement, which he didn't directly say, I'm quitting because of Trump, but I think you can read between the lines. You know, he talks about how the employees of the NIH, of whom about 1,000 have been fired in recent weeks, are individuals of extraordinary intellect and integrity, selfless and hardworking, generous and compassionate. They personify excellence in every way, and they deserve the utmost respect and support of all Americans. And then he goes on to say, when you hear about patients surviving stage 4 cancer because of immunotherapy, that was based on NIH research over many decades. When you hear about sickle cell disease being cured because of CRISPR gene editing, that was built on many years of research supported by the NIH. It is the main piston of a biomedical discovery engine that is the envy of the globe. Yet it is not a household name, but it should be. So there's a real sense there, I think, of people enjoy the fruit of NIH-funded research, and here in the UK, the equivalent kind of government-funded medical research that gradually filters down from kind of cutting-edge trials down to everyday, you know, people living longer but with these diseases like cancer or sickle cell anemia, whatever it is. And yet we have no real idea of the, as you said before, the kind of the mechanism which allows that to happen.
And I think there's another very important point which researchers feel very keenly, and that is if you decide, you know, at a fairly early stage in your career as a scientist, you know, the options open up before you. And one of the options is to go into a commercial field or into military research. And certainly in the commercial field, potentially research scientists can earn large sums of money, you know, or you could create a startup. And clean up, make massive sums of money. But a research scientist who decides I'm going to go into government-funded medical research basically accepts a pretty low salary. I mean, the salaries, you know, are certainly, I mean, they would be equivalent to a sort of blue-collar worker in some areas. They're not well-funded at all. And in the academic world. And you go into this field knowing that you have foregone the possibility of making serious amounts of money because you've got the ability to make the money, and yet you're choosing to go into a field to bury yourself in the hope that you might be able to make some small advance in the care of other human beings. And it is true, the large majority of people in this field are genuinely motivated by those kind of philanthropic ideals. I want to do something significant with my life. But then to see that all being destroyed by what comes across as a kind of fat cat capitalist, by billionaires who have been totally focused on maximizing their own wealth and recklessly destroying. I mean, again, it's deeply painful to watch.
Okay, well, let's do a little bit of devil's advocate here. That's the kind of pro-medical research from an elite Christian research scientist, you know, sticking up for his mates.
His mates, jobs for the mates.
Jobs for the lads, right. Hoping he might get the juicy contract one day to fund his retirement. You know, some people might say, and I'm sure there are some Christians in the Trump administration who say this, you know, look, they're saying, look, this is a bunch of elite left-wing university professors who are taking taxpayers, the hardworking American taxpayers' money, and they're spending it on dubious things. You know, so some of the topics that are now the NIH is not allowed to fund are diversity, equity, and inclusion in science, transgender issues, or research at Chinese universities. Isn't this a good thing that we are refocusing, we're retargeting, we're streamlining medical research so it focuses on non-controversial, non-politicized stuff? We don't let the woke elite university blob infiltrate research and take taxpayers' money to fund its spurious wokery. What would your response to that be?
Well, the truth is that the amount of research that goes into wokery, certainly the NIH, I mean, you know, it might be different if you were thinking about liberal social sciences research. I think, you know, that
cultural studies,
that might well be a fair comment. But the amount of wokery that goes into NIH grants is minuscule. I mean, it would be very hard to detect, which I suspect is part of the problem. They've been thrashing through trying to find some red meat that to throw to the, you know, and finding it rather hard. And actually, don't you think it's rather good to do? Would be good to do some serious medical research into transgender, to gender dysphoria.
You know, to actually know what we're talking about for once, rather than just making stuff up.
Yes, of course there is waste, and yes, I mean, I remember sometimes being feeling deeply aggrieved at the way that money was being given to certain areas which I thought was not really appropriate because of vested interests and all the rest. But nonetheless, it's not a perfect system, but I think the evidence shows that to be honest, the US government at its best, or it was one of the examples you could say, okay, there are lots of reasons to be an anti-American about the impact of America across the world. But when you take the NIH, you could say this was an example of American influence is the best. And then perhaps we should move on and talk about another example of American influence is the best, which is USAID.
Have you ever wrestled with tough questions about faith? Or maybe you've got a friend who's skeptical about Christianity? That's exactly why we want to send you a powerful resource that I believe needs to be in the hand of every believer. Justin Briley's book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. In this book, Justin reflects on 10 years of conversations with atheists, skeptics, and believers alike, and explains why he still finds Christianity the most compelling explanation for life, the universe, and everything in between. I know this book will strengthen your faith and equip you for meaningful conversations. And for a limited time, this book is our special thank you to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support ensures that content like this and other shows and programs are available to bring faith-filled conversations to a world that needs them. So I encourage you to give today by going to premierinsight.org/give. That's premierinsight.org/give. Now on to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Yes, yeah, so this is the America's Agency for International Development, which dates back to, I think it was JFK who started in the early 1960s, or kind of brought it together in one body. And this is basically America's agency, which spends taxpayers' money funding development work around the world. Again, by far the biggest and best known of all the kind of Western development agencies. And it has, even more than NIH, been utterly gutted. In fact, Elon Musk bragged online that he had spent the weekend feeding USAID into the wood chipper, was I think how he cited it. So it's been almost entirely shut down. I think it's gone down from something like 700 plus federal employees down to 70, so 90% cut away. And there's been, even in the interim, there's been a, what's called a stop work order to all of its overseas projects. So the thousands of projects around the world that are funded by grants from USAID, they've all been ordered by the new bosses in Washington that they have to down tools, which is having an extraordinary impact on people who are receiving, often cases, life-saving interventions funded by the American taxpayer.
Yes, I've seen this very much at first hand in a number of visits to sub-Saharan Africa. When I first went to sub-Saharan Africa, it was in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, and there was utter devastation taking place across many African countries. In fact, I remember the first time I visited Uganda, and it would be in the early 1990s. And as I was driving in from the airport, I noticed there was one industry that was clearly booming in every village as you drove in, and that was coffin makers, all the way along the main road into Kampala. There were coffin makers, and this was the just extraordinary death toll of young adults. And it was relatively soon then that the first effective antiviral drugs started to become available, and they were showing a dramatic improvement. They converted AIDS from a universally lethal disease into a disease that could be lived with, often for many years. And the problem was they were extremely expensive, and HIV sufferers in the UK and in the US and Europe started receiving these very expensive drugs. But people looked at Africa and said, there is no way that the millions of people dying of AIDS will ever be able to afford this. And then there was an extraordinary initiative with the initials PEPFAR.
Hmm. That's the president's, it's actually not part of USAID, it's actually a separate system, which has also been gutted and almost shut down by Donald Trump. It's called the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR. That was started by George Bush in 2003, which was basically a kind of centralized funding by the American government to allocate funds around the world to try and save the lives of people suffering from HIV and AIDS. So far, the internet tells me they've allocated over $110 billion towards PEPFAR, which is the largest investment any country has ever made towards combating a single disease, and is estimated as of 2023 to have saved 25 million lives, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa.
So again, an extraordinary evidence of American generosity. You know, there was no political benefit, virtually no political benefit here for this particular initiative. And there was no, it wasn't that, you know, dying people in Africa were going to seriously threaten American wealth. But here was an example of astonishing generosity, which I'm sure was motivated by a Christian understanding of care for the most vulnerable.
Yeah. And it's been terminated as of January this year by Trump. And in fact, I was reading, you know, some of the most kind of upsetting implications of the gutting of USAID. I read a story in the New York Times. I'll leave a link to it in the show notes about it was actually a project trying to test in South Africa, testing a new medical device to try and prevent HIV infection and pregnancy. It involved inserting a silicone ring into women's vaginas. And there was a group of women in a poor rural township in South Africa who had agreed to test this out. And they're in the middle of this trial. And then suddenly the researchers on the ground who were funded by USAID were told they must stop work immediately. So much so they were told they are not permitted to even contact the women in the trial and bring them in to remove this device, which can't be left in their bodies indefinitely. It has to be removed. And so the researchers basically said, you know, we had to decide between obeying the orders from Washington and leaving these women with a potentially dangerous medical device, experimental device in their bodies, with no way of knowing how long it would degrade and what kind of stuff, or to break the rules, even though they're supposed to not spend any money and bring these women in and remove them, which they did thankfully decide to do. But it's kind of an example of how the abruptness and the kind of casual, callous brutality of the way that USAID has been shut down so abruptly has left thousands of people in the middle of trials, life-saving humanitarian trials, good trials that it'd be hard to argue against, completely, you know, abandoned by the American people effectively. You know, the New York Times says they identified 30 studies that had volunteers already in the care of researchers, including trials of malaria treatment in children under 5 in Mozambique, treatments for cholera in Bangladesh, tuberculosis treatment for children in Peru, nutritional support for children in Ethiopia, supporting pregnant and breastfeeding women in Jordan, mRNA vaccine technology for HIV. Like, these are, you know, much like a lot what NIH is doing, these are potentially life-saving transformational research projects that real human beings had generously decided to join in and take the risk to be experimental research subjects. And now they're being just left cast adrift, left in the lurch.
And in particular, they're the classic vulnerable groups, aren't they? These are the widows and the orphans and the aliens, to use the Old Testament language. These are the most vulnerable, the people with no voice. You know, these are children, pregnant women, people of no status, and yet an extraordinary act of compassion and care and generosity just being destroyed. And there have been some estimates, haven't there, about the potential implications of this in terms of
devastating
lives that will be lost, in terms of you know, longer term implications.
Yeah, so there's been a leaked memo from the Assistant Administrator for Global Health at USAID. He has now since been fired once it was emerged.
Surprise,
surprise. Wrote this memo. Yeah, they don't want to hear the consequences of their actions. So he pulled together some data from the agency with the staff he had, few staff he had left, to try and estimate what the impact of the shutdown would be. And the estimates are up to 18 million more cases of malaria a year and as many as 166,000 additional deaths. 200,000 more children paralyzed with polio annually. 1 million more children not treated for severe acute malnutrition, which is often fatal, and more than 28,000 new cases of infectious diseases such as Ebola every year. So this is, again, this is not hypothetical. This is not, you know, cutting off funding to elite woke scientists who are, you know, resisting the people's president. This will have direct knock-on effect. You know, I don't think it's exaggeration to say that Elon Musk and Trump have blood on their hands, because shutting USAID down so abruptly will literally cause people to die who would otherwise be alive.
Yes, and so it's a sorry tale of, and I suspect, you know, people will look back on early 2025 and say this was a dark day for American influence in the world. And obviously we don't want to go into the politics. But I think just thinking as we draw these things to an end about the Christian aspect, and in particular, I'm just struck how little awareness there. You know, these things. I mean, they've been going on over the last few weeks, haven't they? Since January, really. And it just strikes me again how little awareness there has been in the Christian public about this, how little church leaders seem to be aware of this, and also how little a Christian voice there has been in the public square.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think these are stories which are complicated and difficult to follow. They're still unfolding. There's a lot of, like I said, particularly with NIH, there's a lot of to and fro about, you know, Trump issues some order, then a few days later there's a lawsuit in the federal courts which seems to stop it, but is he complying? We're not clear. I think a lot of people are so, and I think there's a very deliberate, there's a tactic called flooding the zone, which is where you kind of, you do so much so quickly that it's almost impossible for the watching world to kind of make head or tail of it. And you, people miss, you know, whereas if he had just said, the one sole thing we're going to do is shut down USAID, there'd be, you know, it'd be front page news. But it's one of 20 slightly insane, unexpected, radical reshaping of the federal government that's gone on in the last 7 days. Who can possibly keep up? So I have some sympathy for people who are vaguely aware that Trump is doing some dramatic things, but is not really clear. It is a hard story to follow. And again, you have to, what is medical research? What is the NIH? Yeah. What is USAID? It's all very technical.
Yeah.
It gets lost in the weeds.
No, I understand that. And really, that's why I felt, although this is a deeply depressing podcast to do, I felt some kind of responsibility as somebody who has a better awareness of why this is important and what the possible implications might be, just to flag this up. But I do sympathize with this sense of being sort of overwhelmed, and as you say, it is a tactic of complete flooding. And and one of the sad reflections I have is that, you know, if in 5 years' time eventually some great audit is done and we can say, you know, exactly how many people died and how many people were paralyzed and how many people and so on, and here are the statistics and here are the evidence, what, you have a horrible feeling to say that the protagonist will say, well, who cares?
Yeah. And I think, you know, we can't have a conversation without addressing the fact that actually a lot of what the Trump administration is doing is enthusiastically supported by some Christians. I mean, most notably, his vice president, J.D. Vance, is a Catholic, a convert to Catholicism, takes his faith very seriously, as we've seen before, you know, tweeting about Latin theological terms in the last few weeks online. This is not something where it's as simple as, you know, the evil atheists are doing something and the church needs to stand up. Actually, there is a conversation to be had within the church about what do we value and what is important to us. And if I could be a little controversial, I might say there are elements of the American church which have got so laser focused on battling woke and getting rid of DEI and fears around gender transition. You know, some of that stuff I might share, some of that theology, some of it I don't, but they've got so focused on that they are perhaps a little blasé about the types of people that they have helped elect to power, who are fundamentally kind of populist vandals. You know, your Elon Musk doesn't care what he breaks, doesn't care whose lives in sub-Saharan Africa are lost, because he's got some grandiose plan about getting to Mars and we need to redirect funds to that, and it's all just woke anyway. And I think there's a degree of discernment needed from some Christians to say, we might share some of the Trump administration's politics on certain flashpoint cultural issues, but actually, are these reliable, credible, trustworthy people to be entrusting the world's most powerful state and its federal architecture to?
Yeah, and interestingly, you know, the Silicon Valley slogan, move fast and break things.
Yeah.
And that works when you're dealing with old-fashioned software and you want to, you know, have a rapid startup. But to apply that philosophy to the way you run the most powerful country in the world. And of course, the assumption is that almost by definition, by breaking things, the things you break are valueless. And it's only by breaking them that good things are going to happen.
Yeah. I'm often reminded of a famous kind of thought experiment, which is called Chesterton's Fence. Have you come across that before, Dad? It's a kind of a thought experiment by the Christian writer, actually, G.K. Chesterton. And he says, you know, imagine you're going somewhere and you suddenly find a fence erected across a road. And he says a certain kind of modern kind of thinking reformer says, well, we don't see the use of this. Let's clear it away. To which a more intelligent person will say, if you don't see what the point is, you certainly mustn't clear it away. You need to go away and think. You need to only when you can come and tell me what this fence was erected for, then you can agree to tear it down. And I think there's this kind of there's a deep wisdom there which says, until you can understand why exactly our forebears built something like the NIH in the way they did, until we know why USAID exists in the way it does, or PEPFAR or any other institution, simply obliterating it because you think you can do it better is incredibly unwise, is incredibly foolish. And Jesus had a lot of things to say about wisdom and foolishness.
The fascinating thing about that philosophy is that sort of philosophy is a cornerstone of what is traditional conservative thinking. Yeah. I think of someone like Roger Scruton, a very well-known conservative political philosopher, who would constantly talk about the intrinsic value of the things that have been developed over decades, centuries, and treasuring these things. So it is utterly extraordinary that a movement which calls itself right-wing conservative in the States is actually adopting a modus vivendi which is the complete reverse of that background.
And I'm aware this is not a podcast about political philosophy, but a lot of that goes back to a philosopher called Edmund Burke, who is a kind of British-Irish philosopher in the late 1800s, and he wrote a very famous Reflections on the Revolution in France, which was just as the kind of French Revolution was literally unfolding. And he kind of staked out the argument for why, even if you were sympathetic to some of the problems of the Ancien Régime, the bad things that the old French government under the King Louis was, the revolution was a incredibly destructive path forward, and therefore evolving gradual incremental change in which we carefully piece together the British system, you know, for example, was carefully evolved over many years. And we got eventually into the same place, universal suffrage and equal rights to men and women, all that stuff. But it took us 150 years of gradual evolution. He would say Burkean conservatism says, let's conserve what is good about the past and only tweak things a little bit. And yet the conservative movement today is unobjectionably a revolutionary movement. It's not an evolutionary movement, it's a revolutionary movement. And people like J.D. Vance and Elon Musk and Donald Trump, and I think there are analogues in our country, in the UK, and in lots of Europe as well, are revolutionaries. They don't want to gradually evolve and piecemeal our way towards a better future. They want to tear down in one big go the old order so that they think they can build something better. And yeah, I find myself increasingly as I get older sympathetic to Burke and the idea that actually when you blow something up, even if it was bad, sometimes it makes things worse.
You're becoming an old fogey, Tim.
Yes. And talking of our country as well, I think we'd be remiss not to mention in passing that our own government, a very, very different type of government to the one Donald Trump leads, the Labour-led government here, centre-left government, has also announced significant cuts to Britain's foreign aid budget and our own, effectively our version of USAID. I think it was supposed to be spending about 0.5% of GDP on aid, and that's going to be cut to 0.3%. So, you know, that's what's that, 40%+ cut, quite a major cut, with that money being spent to boost the defence budget, effectively rearmament.
Yes, and I understand it that even before then, a lot of the aid budget had been diverted from supporting genuine aid in poor countries and was actually used to support illegal immigrants. Asylum seekers and so on. So it had already been massively, unfortunately, diverted from its original aims. And it is another sad reflection. I think, you know, we're moving into a new era, aren't we, in European politics, where rearmament, massively increasing defence spending, is being accepted in many of countries, and that inevitably that's going to have knock-on effects on public spending in other areas.
Yeah, I mean, again, it all flows from Washington, right? Why are European countries scrambling around trying to find more money for defense? It's because Trump has made it very clear that he's got very little interest in using America's military to provide a kind of shield, as has been the consensus across both parties since the end of World War II. And suddenly European countries are looking across at Ukraine and realizing, you know, if we, let alone protect Ukraine, but if we want to defend ourselves and our other allies, you know, your Polands, your Baltic states from Russian aggression, we can't expect the Marines to come flying in to save us anymore. We're going to have to spend money, you know, and I'm sympathetic to that case. And Keir Starmer, our prime minister, would say, you know, I don't have any space to raise taxes. I'm not going to borrow more money. So the only solution is to cut funding elsewhere. And they've decided they've landed upon international aid. I mean, it's a particularly painful transition to say money that would have been spent on mosquito nets is now going to be spent on bullets and bombs. I mean, even if you are, you know, we've made it clear in this podcast before, we're not Christian pacifists. We're not opposed to all, you know, to just use of force in extreme circumstances. But it is uncomfortable, isn't it, to be transitioning spending on money that was going to save lives somewhere else, in theory, is now going to be spent potentially to take someone else's life closer to home.
Yes, and actually, I don't buy that it's not possible to raise taxes at all. This is a bizarre shibboleth that the both political parties got into, particularly on income tax, you know, so that it was just not possible to increase income tax from its basic percentages, which have been fixed for, I think, more than 20 years or something like that. So, and there's absolutely no reason why you couldn't raise like the higher rate of income tax from 40% to 45%. And that would lead to a massive increase in money for the governments, and it's just a lack of political originality, I think, would be my own view. But again, we're not getting into politics. It's just very frustrating, you know. We are still one of the richest countries in the world. You know, we are still something like the fifth or the sixth biggest economies in the world, and the idea that we're all wringing our hands and saying we can't afford it, we just can't afford it. You know, it's rubbish. It's a question of priorities. It's what you want to spend your money on. And at the moment, British people are much more interested in their consumables and ensuring their quality of life and paying for private education or whatever. And maybe there are some other things that are priorities when your country is under threat.
And I think part of the challenge for the church in this new era we're moving into is going to be fighting to retain people's ability to be empathetic and to look beyond their own needs. You know, a lot of the institutions and the charities that received international aid funding when it was spent overseas are actually Christian charities, you know, Tear Fund, Christian Aid, World Vision, Samaritan's Purse, you know, a lot of them, and even sometimes directly churches. I know, for example, the Catholic Relief Church is a kind of relief service that received large amounts of USAID funding, which was supporting kind of poor and vulnerable people around the world. They've made the case, but it's important that that's not just seen as special pleading because we want, you know, we don't want our budgets cut, but actually what I'd love to see the churches make the case that even in times of difficulty and privation, even in times when the threat at home is greater than it might have been for some time, you know, maybe we're returning to another kind of Cold War after a period of relative peace and prosperity. It's still a time in which the wealthiest countries of which, you know, the Western nations are, should still be looking out at which way can we share our wealth with developing nations, even when we feel like we want to tighten our belts and hunker down and batten down the hatches. And I think that's going to be almost a cultural task for the church to kind of try and shape culture there so we don't become too insular, too fearful, too cut off from the rest of the world. Well, let's close it there before we veer into too much political analysis, which is not really what you've signed up to MoLad for. I'm sure we'll return to some of this stuff because, you know, it's a kind of chaotic situation still unfolding. And I think, yeah, I think it increasingly feels like we're at a turning point and we're moving into a different era of modern political international history, for good or for ill. Do keep your comments and thoughts coming in. We love to hear your responses to what we've been talking about today. You know, are we being too harsh on Donald Trump and JD Vance, Keir Starmer? Are we missing the point here about what they're trying to achieve. How can Christians respond well and live faithfully and live wisely in these turbulent times? You can email us molad@premier.org.uk, and we're also interested in school suggestions for what we could talk about next week or in weeks to come. So if you've seen an interesting scientific development or a news story that you'd like to hear us comment on, please do email that in as well. There's plenty of resources on Dad's website, johnwyatt.com, if you're interested in digging more into kind of medical ethics and that kind of stuff. If you'd like to find out some more of my own journalism on the church, you can go to my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, do sign up to my weekly Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend, which is a kind of weekly blast through several interesting stories happening in the church world. And that's it. I think that's everything, isn't it? Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.